All right, you'll be opening your Bibles to the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 24 tonight. We looked last night at the 23rd chapter, and we looked at after a period of time where David went through a lot of schemes in which he was trying to avoid Saul on his own without really seeking the direction of God. We saw in the last chapter where he returns to trusting in the Lord, and we see numerous times that he inquired of the Lord. He went to the Lord in prayer and sought God's will to know what to do. And as he did that, I think he could see and understand how God, when he did that, took care of his needs. Not that God didn't take care of his needs before, but he learned a little bit more about how important it is to trust the Lord and to seek God's will. And certainly that's something we need to do in our own lives, and seek the Lord's will, seek to please the Lord in all that we do. And David did that. We know that the very last thing that happened is that Saul had just about closed in on David. They were on opposite sides of a mountain, but Saul was pursuing with his troops and just about had them hemmed in, and before they could take them, he gets a message that said the Philistines had invaded the land, and Saul was forced to go back and to assume his duties as the ruler or the commander of the armies of Israel, and to protect the people of Israel from the invading Philistines. And so David was saved. And so David moved on from the place that he was. He went up from there and he dwelt, it says, the last verse in 23 says he dwelt in the strongholds in Gedi. And so that's where we pick up tonight. Now, Saul, certainly nothing has happened in his life to change his attitude, to change his heart. He's still intent on taking David, and so he continues that pursuit as soon as he gets through dealing with the Philistines. Look with me in chapter 24, verse 1. He said, "Now it happened when Saul had returned from following the Philistines that it was told him, saying, 'Take note, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi.' And Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel, and he went to seek David and his men on the rocks of the wild goats. And so he came to the sheepfolds by the road where there was a cave. And Saul went in to attend to his needs, and David and his men were staying in the recesses of the cave." We'll stop right there for just a second. Saul finished dealing with the Philistine invasion. We're really not told what happened with it. I don't know, but the threat must have been removed. The Philistines must have been, I would think, chased back to their own land. And so as soon as that's over, as soon as he finished, he returned and went after David again. And he was told, he says, David has moved on. David is now staying in the wilderness of En-Gedi. That word En-Gedi means of the goats, or of the kids of the goats is the idea there. And so Saul, look at verse 2. Saul takes 3,000 chosen men. These are select men. Where does he take them from? Where do they come from? All Israel. From all Israel. You know, it's almost like Saul went out and said, "Well, how successful has he been so far?" Let's put it that way. We ask the question, how successful has his attempts to take David been so far? Not at all. So I think one of the things that must be running through his mind is, I need better men. I need more men. I need better men. And so he goes out, and from all Israel, he takes 3,000 chosen men, the select, the best army, officers, the best army, the best soldiers he can find. And he takes this large select group, and he goes after David. He went to seek David, and he went to seek his men on the rocks of the wild goats. Now, this is an interesting title here to this place. The rocks of the wild goats literally means this. It's named this because it was an area that was accessible only to wild goats. That's why it was called that, the rocks of the wild goats. It was an area that they could get along good in that area, but if men tried to work around in that area or move around that area, it would be very dangerous. It would be very difficult. And yet, does that faze him at all? David's hiding in the ideal place. He's hiding in a place which is tough to get to. There are a lot of hiding places there, and it's a tough place for anybody to chase him at. But Saul goes after him anyway. It doesn't matter. He endangers himself and those closest to him, but he also endangers the 3,000 choice and best soldiers in his army. He doesn't bat an eye at doing that. And so he goes after David even in that place. I mean, David is led to a good place. If any one thing was going to deter Saul from chasing him, that would have been the perfect place. And yet it didn't deter Saul at all. You almost see a little bit of madness. in Saul. A little bit of insanity. He doesn't think through this through at all. We know he doesn't think things through spiritually, but even logically now, it doesn't make much sense for him to continue this pursuit in this way. How much danger is David to him way out there in the wilderness? I mean, just thinking about that. He's so afraid of David. Is David chasing him? Is David after him? Is he pursuing him? No. David's gone way away, which is probably would think would be the ideal thing for Saul. David's far away. He's not there where he can influence the people of Israel. He's only got a small group there with him. He's got 600 people with him. That's all he's got. Why bother to chase him all the way out there? And yet he does anyway. So he comes to this place. Look at verse 3. He comes to this place. He comes to the sheepfold by the road. And there's a cave there. There's a cave there. There were probably lots of caves in that area. There are some people today who believe that that cave can actually be pinpointed and identified. The one that they think it is actually a cave with a very, very small opening to it. But inside, it's quite large. It's a quite a large cave, but it wouldn't be one that you could spot very easily because the opening is fairly small. So Saul goes in. It says he went in to attend to his needs or his business. The King James says he went in to cover his feet. There are different ideas about what that means. I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but the most reasonable thing seems to me that he went in to rest and take care of his own personal needs. He's chasing David all over the place. He's tired. He needs to rest. They find a place that's safe to do that. And he goes in to do that and probably to cover his feet up as he sleeps there in this place. And so that's where he goes in. What he didn't know, what he didn't understand and realize, that David is already in that cave. David and his men are in that cave. Now, and David's got a pretty good group of men, and you see, for them to be in that cave, you can see how large it is. But they're not there at the entrance, they're in the recesses. They're far back in the cave. But they're there, and I guess Saul and his men didn't all come in there. 3,000 men didn't come into that cave, but Saul and his entourage of his own personal attendants and so forth, they went inside the cave. But David and his men are there in the recesses of the cave. Luck? Chance? Now, we see the providence of God at work in all of this. Now, the question is, how will David respond to this? Because Saul doesn't, know he's there. But David knows Saul is there. And David's men know that, too. Look at verse 4. The men of David said to him, "This is the day of which the Lord said to you, 'Behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand, that you may do to him as it seems good to you.'" Interesting statement. His men look at this and they say, "This is the day. This is the day we've been waiting for." Because, as David's been pursued all this time, somebody else has been pursued too, haven't they? I mean, they chose to align themselves with David, no question about that. But these men chose to align with David, but they've been pursued as well. They've been running from Saul's army and from Saul all this time as well. They know what Saul has tried to do. I'm sure everybody's heard that, Saul has tried several times, at least 3 times that we know of, to pin David to the wall with his own spear. While David was doing what? Playing for him to soothe his distressed spirit. While David was doing something good for Saul, Saul tries to pin him to the wall. He's done that 3 times. So they know that he hates David, that he's trying to kill David. That's certainly the purpose of all this. And they see that as their opportunity. This is the day. There's a verse of Scripture that says that. In fact, there's a song that we sing sometimes that quotes that verse of Scripture. This is the day which the Lord hath made. We will rejoice and be glad in it. I don't know if that passage was even written at this time. Very likely well not. They didn't know it. But that's certainly the idea, I think, that they had in their heads. This is the day that the Lord has made. We're going to rejoice and be glad in it because this is our opportunity to do what?
To kill our enemy.
And so, and this is what they say about it. This is the day, he says, of which the Lord said to you, David, "Behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand, that you may do to him as it seems good to you." Now let me ask you this question. Do you know, of everything we've read so far, studying the life of David, can you remember a place where we read that God said that to David?
It doesn't make sense, because Benjamin is mine, he says.
Yeah, I mean, this is. I don't know that God ever said that to David, that "I will deliver him into your hand, you do to him what you want to." I mean, that's kind of the application, that's kind of the implication of what they're saying. So I think this is not something necessarily that God ever actually said, although this is probably what these men heard. Something in what God did say to David This is how they interpreted it. We do that sometimes, do we not? When we listen to what people say, you know, and there are certain things that we want to hear, and we want to hear it so bad that we almost just pretend like we did hear that. And maybe that's what these men did. I don't know. But there's no record of this. And in one sense, thinking about it, God giving David carte blanche and saying, you can do whatever you want to him, is that consistent with God's character? Or with God's will? No, it's not. No. So I think this is basically the ideas of David's men. Can we understand their feelings? From a human standpoint, you can understand their feelings. And, you know, was Israel a nation that kind of liked to look at signs? And I imagine that went through their minds too. This is a sign. You know, this is a sign. God's arranged this. This didn't happen by chance. They didn't think it was chance either. They believe God arranged this. And we need to take advantage of the opportunity that God has given us. And so I think that's what they're doing. I don't know if they actually hate Saul. They certainly haven't learned that from David, if they do. But, you know, these are men that were not, you know, exactly probably the most spiritual men you could imagine. Although they did make a very good decision in aligning themselves with David and being willing to suffer with David. I think that's an important thing to say, that there is some level of spirituality here. But in this case, they're wanting to have Saul killed. And they, you know, in a sense, they're a source of temptation to David, are they not? You know, just the event happening itself, just Saul being there and being available for David to take, is a temptation right there. But then to have all your men encouraging you to do it, to have somebody else tell you, yeah, it's a good idea. You know, what do you think we should do? Yeah, let's kill him. I mean, you can see how they're a temptation as well. Sometimes those around us are not always the best sources of direction in our lives, because sometimes they get pulled away with the flesh just like we do. So now, I want you, before you jump too quick on this, let's not completely eliminate the idea of what they said being actually true. Well, they ask this. Look at the first part of it. Is this the day which the Lord delivered David's enemy into his hand?
Yes.
And did God, in a sense, give him the chance to do to him as it seemed good to David? You see, you take that. Don't take that in a negative sense, because David does do what seems good to him. And he doesn't kill him. I'll tell you that. Spoil the ending, aren't they? Sorry. You heard this story before. You know this. So in one sense, I think God has, in a sense, presented that opportunity to David. And it's, in a sense, I guess, the testing of his faith and it's the trying of his faith. What will David do? How will David handle this? What will good seem good to David to do in this particular case? And so let's see what he does. Look at the last part of verse 4. Last part of verse 4, it says, David arose and he secretly cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Which to me pretty much implies that Saul was doing what? It's likely asleep. And not just Saul, but probably everybody around Saul. Now, I don't know if this was some magical sleep that God placed in them in or something like that. You wonder why there wasn't somebody awake to guard the king. You would think somebody was there as the king's bodyguard. He would have been awake through this. But for some reason, nobody evidently was alert or awake, because David is able to go up to the king and cut off a corner of his robe. And that's all he does. That's all he does. Now look at the next statement. I think this is interesting. The next statement in verse 5 says this. He says, it happened afterward that David's heart troubled him because he had cut Saul's robe. Now, not because he had cut Saul's throat, but because he had cut Saul's robe. And you think about that and say, well, why? Why was that? I mean, David's heart troubled him. The word troubled literally means David's heart, struck him. He was smitten by his heart. It was a wound in his heart. It was a grief in his heart. It was a guilt that he felt in his heart. He felt guilty over what he had done. Now, if the other people are standing around, David's men are standing around thinking they're feeling probably disappointed because he didn't cut his throat, because he didn't do that. But he's disappointed. He's grieved because he cut Saul's robe. Now, why? Why did this trouble David so much? Why do you think? Yeah, you said the same thing. He's still the Lord's anointed. God hasn't removed him, unless you might reason. I mean, I'm sure that David's men probably reasoned, this is the way God has chosen to remove him from being king, to deliver him into your hands and let you kill him. But David doesn't see it that way at all. He says, this is still the Lord's anointed. You know, God hasn't removed him from this, and I don't think he's chosen me to be the one to remove him in this way. So that's one of the things that bothers him. What else?
Well, he respects the position of authority, which is what you're saying. You know, regardless of Saul, I don't think he respects Saul personally, but
right.
He respects the position he holds where God is placing him.
Yeah, he's still David's what? He's David's king. He's David's king, and God placed that, you know, that man in that position as king. In fact, who does place people in government positions? God does, doesn't he? You know, and so he's looking at that. So he respects David's, he respects King Saul as his own king. What else might he have been upset about?
Influence of the people of his men, you know, they're saying go kill him, and you know, he just took his robe, but for what purpose? To boast, or to, you know, say, look how close I could have killed him, you know, I mean,
right.
You could have taken him.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know exactly what David's motivation was, but it must not have been right, or he wouldn't have been so upset about what he did. So his motivation might not have been right in this as well. What else do we know that he didn't do, or that there's no record of him doing it? He's done something he did in the last chapter numerous times. He didn't ask God's will. What do you want me to do? He didn't seek God's will in this. He didn't say, Lord, what do you have me to do? He just goes in and does this. You know, kind of a rash act in one way, but a very, you know, controlled act in one sense. So he hasn't literally harmed the king, but he did do what? He says, I will not lift up my hand against the Lord's anointed. But he did. I mean, it was a very benign type of thing, just cutting his robe, cutting a piece of his robe. But he did lift up his hand against the Lord's anointed. And again, the other thing is, he doesn't want to give his men, again, it's like you said, he doesn't want to give his men the idea that, yeah, we can do whatever we want to this soul. I did this. You do what you want to. I think he's worried about how they're going to respond, because there's a lot of them. I mean, David is one man, and, you know, we're looking at all these men, and very easily they could overpower him, and they could take this as a sign to go even further. And so David speaks to them. Look at the next verse. Verse 6. David said to his men, the Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my master, the Lord's anointed. Two things. He says, he's my master, but he's also the Lord's anointed. God forbid, the Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, seeing that he is the anointed of the Lord. The first thing he recognizes is that Saul is my master. I'm his servant. I am the servant of King Saul because I am a part of the nation of Israel. I am a servant to whoever is king of that nation. And not only that, but the Lord himself is the one who's put him in that position. So he says, I'm not going to stretch out my hand against him, seeing that he is the Lord's anointed. It's interesting. A lot of times you see that word my used throughout this chapter. Sometimes in reference to David, sometimes in reference to Saul. But you need to always contrast and say, what is this person doing? What my will, my wisdom, my hand versus God's will. And God's wisdom, and God's hand. He says, I'm not going to lift up my hand against him. God will have to lift up his hand against Saul to remove him, because he's the one who put him in there. And look at verse 7. And so David restrained his servants, his men, with these words. Restrained, meaning what? He stopped them. He stopped them from doing what they wanted to do, because evidently maybe they had taken a little bit of courage at what David had done and said, all right, David cut his robe, we can go after this guy. And he restrained them with these words, and he did not permit them to rise against Saul. He kept them back. And you can see the respect that David has. You know, they could very easily have overpowered him, but they respected David. He's provided good leadership for these men. So they respect him. They respect his reasons for doing this. It's not like they didn't think he was right. He's the voice of reason on all this. You know, we can't do this. I will not do it, and I will not allow you to do it either. He is the Lord's anointed. So he restrained his servants. And then, last part of verse 7, then Saul got up from the cave, not knowing any of this had happened. He and his men, he says, and he went out, and he went on his way. Interesting. Went on his way. He wasn't going God's way at all in this, was he? He went on his way. And David lets him go. Look at verse 8. First time, I mentioned this. This is the first time David would spare Saul's life. First time he would spare Saul's life. Look at verse 8. David also arose afterward, and he went out of the cave, and he called out to Saul, saying, "My Lord, the King." And when Saul looked behind him, David stooped with his face to the earth and he bowed down. David said to Saul, "Why do you listen to the words of men who say, 'Indeed, David seeks your harm'?" Saul goes out of the cave. He's, you know, what's he thinking about? Saving David. I mean, where do we go now? You know, we've covered this area. Where do we go now? Where are we going to seek and where are we going to find him? So he's intent on going after David still. And all of a sudden, he hears a voice. Must have startled him to hear that voice. That voice is where? Behind him. Oh, you don't want your enemy behind you, do you? Now, when you're unawares. So he hears this voice behind him. It's David. And he calls out. What does he call him? "My Lord, the King." "My Lord, the King." And Saul looked behind him. I'm sure, you know, Saul is probably worried. Is it really David? Am I just mistaken? He's calling me "My Lord, the King." I wouldn't expect that from David. And so he hears those words. And I think one of the things he turns around quickly to see if it's true, if this really is David behind him. Does he see David standing there defiantly holding up the corner of Saul's robe and saying, "Look here, look what I've got"? He doesn't do that at all. What does he turn around and see? David is stooped down with his face to the earth, bowed down. Bowed down. And do you want to do that before your enemy? For the man who's trying to kill you? Now, I don't know how far apart they are at this point in time. There's probably a pretty good distance there. But because David had to shout out to him, I believe, probably. And so he sees him there, bowed down with his face to the ground, a man who is now calling him "My Lord, the King." We see two things here. Number one, you see David's humility. David humbled himself before this man, even though this man was trying to kill him. He humbled himself before his enemy, before the king, his king. And he honored Saul. Not only did he humble himself before Saul, but he honored Saul, recognizing him as the king, as God's anointed. And let me ask you this. Was that important to Saul? That he be recognized as king? That he be honored? See, and I think David understood that. He says, you know, that's something Saul will respond to. He'll respond to someone who shows him honor. And I don't think that's the only reason. I don't think it's a false thing. I don't think it's a false act on David's part. I think he really does honor him. But he also knows, practically speaking, that Saul will respond positively to that. And, you know, I think that's something that we can learn as well, you know, as far as recognizing that people that are in positions of authority, government positions and so forth, what should be our attitude as Christians toward them? You know, think about that. Look with me at a couple of passages. Two passages. The first one's Romans chapter 13. This is kind of the standard passage usually turned to for this. And this is a hard thing, I think, sometimes for people to do. This is a hard thing sometimes for Christians to do, because Christians have usually pretty strong political opinions. And it's hard not to react negatively to people that are in positions of authority who have different opinions than us, are not running the country or the city or the state in the way that we think is right, the way that we think is in accordance with God's word, not according to God's will, and maybe it's not morally or ethically right in our eyes and so forth. How do we react to people like that? And I think Romans 13 gives us a good picture of that. And I think David gives us a good example of that. Look at verse 1. He said, "Let every soul be," what's the next word?
Subject.
In submission to, he says, the governing authorities. "For there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. Rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. If you want to be unafraid of the authority and do what is good, and you'll have praise from the same. For he is God's minister." How many of you look at, you know, our president or our governor or our congressman and look at them as God's ministers? Maybe we should sometimes. You know, maybe we should recognize that they're in that position because God has given them that authority. You know, and we need to recognize that authority. Now, we live in a country where we've got some nice privileges. We live in a country where we get to vote on those things. So there are some countries where they don't get to vote on their leader at all. Much tougher for them, I would think, especially when you see, you know, the oppression that comes from some government leaders and so forth. But we live in a country where we can't express our opinions, and that's fine. Nothing says you can't express your opinion. And you certainly can vote. You can do those things as well, and we can express our ideas and so forth. But I think sometimes that we're not careful, we disrespect, as Gary said a minute ago, the office. That we equate the man in the office as the same. We disrespect a person who holds that office when we shouldn't. Are we going to disagree with them? We can vote against them. But, I think that there needs to be respect from Christians for people in those positions. And so he says in verse 4, he is God's minister to you for good. But if you do evil, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. He is God's minister, an avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil. Therefore, you must be subject not only because of wrath, but also for conscience sake, which means it's the right thing to do. The right thing to do. For because of this, you also pay taxes. Now, we're certainly aware of that this year. I've been working on my taxes lately. I don't like it. I'm going to have to pay the government a pretty good chunk this year, so I don't like that at all. But, that's just a part of living in this country. That's part of our laws and so forth. And we need to respect that and submit to it. It says, they are God ministers attending continually this very thing. Therefore, render to all their due. Even Jesus said this. What did he say? Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. I think that's a good principle, even that's applicable today for us and living in this country. So that's one of the things. Render therefore to all their due. Taxes to whom taxes are due. Customs to whom customs. Fear to whom fear. What's the last one say?
Honor
to whom honor. And I think that's important for us as Christians. And I think it's a testimony to those around us that we do at least respect and show honor to people that are in positions of authority. And we need that. There's one other thing we need to do for them too, though, and that's important too. Look in 1 Timothy chapter 2. Look at verse 1. 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 1. And these are instructions to Timothy as a pastor of a church and instructions that he would be giving to those who were members of that local church there at Ephesus. He says, therefore I exhort, first of all, I encourage, first of all, that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for who? For all men. For to pray for all men. In particular, verse 2. For kings and all who are in authority. And I know that I'm guilty of this. I don't pray enough for our leaders. And we need to. As Christians, I think that's an important part of our life and our ministry is to pray for them. Why do we pray? It's that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and reverence. Now, why do we do it? Verse 3, because this is good and acceptable. And that word means well-pleasing to the sight of God our Savior, who desires all men to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. I think that's why one of the things we need to do is we need to do pray for those who are in those positions. And so David demonstrated that here for a man who's trying to kill him. A man who's doing everything he can to kill David and to take his own men. He honored him in this way. But he also questioned Saul. He questioned Saul. Look at go back with me to 1 Samuel 24, look at verse 9. He said, why? He asked a question to Saul. Why? Why do you listen to the words of men who say, indeed, David seeks your heart? Now, in one sense, I think that, that's kind of just an excuse that Saul had. But there were those, evidently, that were telling Saul, David seeks to kill you. I think he was getting a lot of bad advice. I think he had some bad advisors. David will take your throne. He's going to kill you if he gets the opportunity. He says, why do you listen to those men? You're listening to the words of men rather than the word of who? God. You're not listening to the word of God. You're listening to the words of men. Why would you listen to those who say that David seeks your harm? So David seeks to hurt you, to harm you, to kill you. I mean, you think about what Saul believed. Saul believed that Jonathan, if you go back to 1 Samuel 22, verses 7 and 8, Saul believed that even Jonathan, his own son, had stirred up David against Saul and was lying in wait to take him and kill him. He believed the same thing of the priests of Israel. He believed the same thing about those priests, that they had conspired with David to rise up against Saul and to lie in wait to take him. So he's listened to the words of men. David said, why? Why would you listen to them? Rather than listen to your heart and what you know God tells you in His Word, you listen to the words of men. We need to be very careful taking the advice of men or listening to the teachings of men. We always need to question, I think, what men say and say, does it line up with what God says in His Word? And Saul wasn't doing that. Look what he goes on and says in verse 10. He says, look. He says, just take an honest look here for a minute of what's just happened. Look, this day your eyes have seen. You've seen this with your own eyes. It's not some, you didn't get this from, secondhand information. This is not a report you got. You've seen this with your own eyes that the Lord delivered you today into my hand in that cave. And you know it. Because David's probably standing where? And probably right outside the entrance to the cave, be my guess. And Saul is far enough away that he can talk to him without throwing spears at each other and so forth. And so, you know, he says, you know that the Lord delivered you today into my hand in the cave. And it says, and someone urged me to kill you. There were a bunch of someone probably urging David to kill him. He had a lot of encouragement to kill him. And, you know, the reasoning that God had made it possible. He says, someone urged you, he says, urged me to kill you. But he says, but my eye spared you. I spared your life. He says, I could have killed you. That was no question about that. He could have killed him. He says, but I spared you. And I said, I will not stretch out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. He acknowledged again that you're my king. You're my king, and you're the king that my God appointed. He showed his faithfulness to Saul as his king. He showed his faithfulness to the Lord and acknowledging what God had done. I'm going to follow God's will in regard to that. You know, David was a loyal servant, but he was also someone who was willing to wait. Willing to wait. That's a hard thing, isn't it? What do we call that? What's the word? Patience. You know, I always say, the Lord's teaching me patience, because it seems like we never learn that lesson, do we? This is the thing that David's having to learn, is it not? Patience. Because, many years ago now, he's been anointed to be the king of Israel. And I'm sure the question in his mind is, when is it going to happen? When is it going to happen? And in the meantime, not only is he just not sitting there waiting, but he's having to run for his life during that whole period that he's waiting. He's learned, I think, through all of this, the importance of trusting God and of waiting upon God. Read the 37th. Well, let's go look at just a portion of it. The 37th Psalm, I think, just expresses what David is learning through this experience so well. Let's just read the first few verses of it here. Verse 1 says this. He says, do not fret because of evildoers. And that certainly qualifies. That's what Saul is right now. What he's doing is evil. What he's doing is wrong. He says, nor be envious of the workers of iniquity. That's Saul too. For they shall soon be cut down like the grass and wither as the green herb. Don't worry about them. They're not going to continue to be able to do that forever. They're going to be judged. It's going to happen. What does verse 3 say? Trust in the Lord and do what? And do good. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and feed on His faithfulness. Had the Lord been faithful to David? Every step of the way. Every step of the way He's been faithful. Delight yourself also in the Lord. There's probably not a whole lot of delight in wandering around the wilderness of En-Gedi or the wilderness of Maon, not knowing where the food's going to come from, and not knowing where you're going to hide, and not knowing somebody's going to be behind you. There's not a whole lot of delight in what he was going through from a physical standpoint, from a lifestyle standpoint. So what do you have to do? Delight yourself also in the Lord, and He shall give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust also in Him, and He shall bring it to pass. He shall bring forth your righteousness as the light and your justice as the noonday. It'll happen. He'll bring it forth in His time. Rest in the Lord and do what? Wait patiently for Him. Do not fret because of him who prospers in his way, because of the man who brings wicked schemes to pass. Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Do not fret. It only causes harm. It's only going to cause more damage to you. He said, you don't need to do that. Evildoers shall be cut off. But those who wait on the Lord shall inherit the earth. For yet a little while, and the wicked shall be no more. Indeed, you will look carefully for his place, but it shall be no more. But the meek, those who are willing to wait and trust in the Lord, that's what meekness means. It means trusting that whatever is going on, that God knows what's best. That's the idea. The meek shall inherit the earth. They shall delight themselves in the abundance of peace. David, I think, understood that. At least certainly at this point in time, when he had the opportunity to kill Saul, he understood that, and so he waits upon the Lord. Now look at go back to 1 Samuel 24, look at verse 11. David then makes a personal appeal, not just as the servant of Saul and of Saul as his king, but he's got another relationship with Saul, does he not? Verse 11, he says, moreover, my father, see, look at this. What does he call him? Why? He's son-in-law for Saul, so he's married to Michael, Saul's daughter. So he calls him father because that's what he is. Moreover, my father, see the corner of your robe in my hand. And now he probably holds it up, maybe for the first time. I don't know if Saul even noticed that it's gone yet. It's just a small corner of his robe. It's gone, but he holds it up, and I'm probably can sure see either the fabric or the color or something, and no, that's mine. I'm sure he takes a look down there to see. Yes, it is. He, see the corner of your robe in my hand. For in that I cut off the corner of your robe and I did not kill you, what did he cut it off with? He had something sharp, did he not? Probably a knife. And he probably got a knife or a sword, something that he'd very easily have cut Saul's head off. He could have killed him. He could have stabbed him, anything. He said, I didn't kill you. No, and see that there is neither evil nor rebellion in my hand. The word evil means intent to harm. I have no intention, no desire to harm you. And he says, and there's no rebellion in my hand either. Rebellion is to take the throne. I'm not here to take the throne away from you. That's not what I'm trying to do. David never stepped forward to try to take the throne away from Saul. The reason that Saul was worried is because David shone. David shined in comparison to Saul when it came to the battlefield. And he shined when it came to character and morals. I mean, and you look at the two of them. But he wasn't trying to take the throne. He says, that's not in my hand. It also wasn't in his heart. It wasn't in his heart. So he says, I have not sinned against you. And David's not saying he's sinless. But he's saying, in regard to you, I have not sinned against you. Yet, you hunt my life to take it. Is that the proper response to the way I've behaved towards you? Is that the proper response to the way that I've treated you? I'm not trying to harm you. I'm not trying to take your throne. That's, I haven't sinned against you. And yet you hunt my life to take it. Is that sin? Is there a reason that he's trying to kill David? Not a good reason. I mean, the only reason is to say envy, jealousy, fear, hatred, those types of things. That's sin on Saul's part. And sin against David without a cause. Verse 12. He says, let the Lord judge between you and me. I'm not going to sit here in judgment. He says, well, let the Lord judge between you and me. Well, let the Lord avenge me on you. But my hand shall not be against you. He realizes David, in a sense, is due vengeance on Saul. Is he not? Because of what Saul's done to him repeatedly and doggedly pursuing him in that way. But he says, I'm going to leave vengeance in the hand of the Lord. I'm going to leave the judgment and the decision in the hand of the Lord to judge between you and I, which one of us is right, which was wrong. And I'm going to leave vengeance in the hand of the Lord. My hand shall not be against you. Look at verse 13. A subtle thing here. I guess you could call it subtle. Maybe it's not so subtle. He says, it's just as the proverb of the ancients says, wickedness proceeds from the wicked. I mean, you can look at what you've done and look at what I've done. Which one is wicked? Which one is evil? Which one is wrong? Let the Lord judge, but it's obvious to anybody who would take an open mind and look at it. What Saul has been doing is wicked. Wickedness comes from where? It comes from the wicked. There's a wickedness that is in Saul's deeds that comes from a wickedness that is in his heart. That's what David's telling him. That's what David is telling him. Look at Matthew 7. Jesus gives a similar lesson to the Jews of his day, particularly something directed, I think, at the Jewish rulers, but in a sense directed at the majority of the people in Israel at that time. This is the last part of what's commonly referred to as the Sermon on the Mount. And he's giving them a warning against those that are false prophets, those who claim to speak for God, but what they say is false, or the fact is they're not prophets of God at all. Now, we usually think of false prophets as being those who pretend to be able to tell the future and things like that. But let me ask you this. Would you think that the scribes and Pharisees were false prophets? Did they claim to speak for God? They did they not? And a lot of what they said, the majority of what they said, was false. Well, he says in verse 15, beware, this is Matthew 7:15, beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing. Or you could say in religious garb, maybe. Priests, Pharisees, Sadducees, so forth. He says, they come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravenous wolves. They're out to kill you and ravage you. He says, you'll know them by what? By the fruits. He says, do men gather grapes from thorn bushes? Or figs from thistles? No, those plants don't give that kind of fruit because that's not what it is by nature. And he goes on, he says, even so, every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a bad tree bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit, he says, what happens to it? Cut down and throw it in the fire. Therefore, by their fruits you will know them. And that's what David is saying to Saul, I believe, in effect. He says, wickedness comes, wicked deeds, wicked behavior comes and proceeds from a wicked heart. And that's what he's trying to get. There's wickedness in your heart, Saul. That's what the problem is. Going back to 1 Samuel 24. Once again, what does he reiterate? He says at the end of verse 12, "My hand shall not be against you." And after he tells Saul what's going on, he still reiterates and says, "But my hand shall not be against you. Even though what you're doing is wicked and it's coming out of a wicked heart, my hand is not going to be the one against you." And then he says in verse 14, here's a piercing question. "After whom has the king of Israel come out?" Who are you chasing out here? He says, "Whom do you pursue? A dead dog? A flea?" I mean, think about the situation here. Who are you coming out? What's Saul's army look like? How many people are in his army? 3,000. And where did he get them? He went to all Israel and got the best. He selected the chosen best, you know, army, you know, of Israel that he could put together. How many people did David got? There's 600 now. And where did he get them? The distressed came to him, and all those who were in debt came to him, and all those who were discouraged in their life, they came to him. So, you know, compare this army with this army. You know, who have you come out against? A dead dog. What kind of danger is a dead dog to a person? How much danger can a dead dog present to you? How much should you fear it? I mean, if it was a rabid dog, you wouldn't go close to it and touch it, that type of thing. But, I mean, as long as you stay away from it, it's going to be fine. David is no more, he says, "I'm no more than that. I'm not a harm to you. I'm not a danger to you." He says, and not only is a dead dog, what's the other example he gives?
Flea.
How many fleas?
One.
Just one. One flea. Hard to find, isn't it? Yep. That's David. Hard to find, hard to grab hold of. How much danger? How much harm can that one flea do? You know? Irritation maybe a little bit, but other than that, no danger. Because what have you come out? What kind of threat are we to you, Saul, that you come out against us with this kind of army? And so he says in verse 15, "Therefore let the Lord be judge, and judge between you and me, and see. And let him plead my case, and let him deliver me out of your hand." And again, David's still doing what? David's still trusting God. "I'll just let the Lord take care of this. I'll let him plead my case. I'll let him defend me. I'll let him judge. I'll let him avenge. I'll let him deliver me out of your hand." Because he trusts and knows. And I know he will. And so it was when David had finished speaking these words to Saul that we see that Saul is still human. He's not completely given over to an evil spirit. He's not demon possessed. There are some believe that evil spirit was actually demon possession in Saul's case. I never have believed that. Never have seen that. I don't think that's the case. But, he's not beyond help, I guess you might say. He can still be touched with things. And you see that here. So it was when David had finished speaking these words to Saul, that Saul said, "Is this your voice, my son David?" Now, he's heard enough so far that he knows this is David's voice. But he says, "Is this your voice, my son David?" He can't believe that David's caught up to him, I think, in that way. But he also probably can't believe what David didn't do here. He can't believe what David didn't do. David had the chance to kill him. And he'd been told by all of these friends and advisors that David will kill you if he's got the chance. And he didn't do it. He says, "Is this your voice, my son?" What does he call him? My son, David. He's touched. He sees that. He looks at this. This is the husband of my daughter. And Saul lifted up his voice. And what did he do? He wept. And that's why I say he can still be touched. Now, sometimes emotions are just emotionalism. You know, and I don't think that's the case here. I don't think this is just emotionalism. I think that Saul was truly touched by what happened here. I think that his heart was affected by this. What do you think he wept? What do you think he's feeling right now? Guilt. I think guilt is part of it. I think he's been touched and sees and knows that what he's done is wrong. And so I think he feels guilty over this. I think there's sorrow there that he's done this. I think there's anguish of soul. I think there's anguish at what he had done. And because he thinks back to all the things that he'd done in pursuing David, all the things that he'd done, things that he'd done to David, things he'd done to Jonathan, what he did to the priests, you know, ordering the death of the priests. I think there's anguish at what he had done. I think there's a little bit of anguish at what he had become. What he has become, and he knows it in his heart, at least for a short time, he knows it in his heart. And so he expresses these words. Look what he says, verse 17. He said to David, "You are more righteous than I." And he was, basically, as far as his behavior. Now, Both of them, even if we look at it from a standpoint of sinners, both of them are sinners, are they not? Neither one of them is righteous as far as their deeds. But just as far as, my goodness is enough to save me and your goodness is not enough to save you type of thing. No, he's just saying, you have behaved more righteously than I have. You have done God's will when I haven't. He says, for you have rewarded me with good, whereas I have rewarded you with evil. Did Saul deserve any good? No. No, not for what he had done. Did David deserve the evil that Saul had given him? No. He's been unjust in what he's done on both sides. He says, you have shown, you have demonstrated this day how you have dealt well with me. For when the Lord delivered me into your hand, you didn't kill me. He could have. He could have. But he didn't. And Saul knows that. He says, and it doesn't make any sense. He says, for if a man finds his enemy, will he let him get away safely? I mean, that just doesn't happen typically. David's got a different kind of heart, doesn't he? You really see an example here of a man after God's own heart in David that you don't typically see in other men. And that's what Saul recognizes. I mean, a man just doesn't let his enemy get away safely. And yet, that's what you've done. Because the difference here is, how does Saul look at David? He looks at him as an enemy. How does David look at Saul? He doesn't look at him as an enemy. He doesn't like what he's doing to him. He's a human being. He doesn't like what he's, having to put up with. But he doesn't look at Saul as enemy. This is the father of his wife. This is the father of his best friend. This is his king. This is the Lord's anointed. That's how he sees him. He says, and so Saul, in a sense, still doesn't understand this. And verse 19 again, he says, therefore may the Lord reward you with good for what you have done to me this day. He recognizes David's needs to be rewarded for what he's done and rewarded with good. And he says in verse 20, and now I know indeed, I know surely that you shall surely be king and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand. He believes that. He says, I realize now that you are going to be king. The kingdom of Israel is going to be established in your hand. Now, if he really believed that, what would he do? God, has he been told that God is going to take the kingdom away from him? In fact, he's been told that God has already taken the kingdom away from him. What should he do? He should step down, should he not? If he truly believed that God has anointed David to be king, God has removed him from being king, he should step down. He's not that far along, see? He's not that far along. So he recognizes and he acknowledges that David is going to be king. So, verse 21, what does he say? Verse 21, he says, therefore swear now to me by the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants after me and that you will not destroy my name from my father's house. When you become king, don't wipe out my house. Don't wipe out my descendants. Because oftentimes when a king comes in and there's a change of dynasty, what do? You make sure that all the previous heirs are gotten rid of. Happened a lot in various places, various kingdoms and so forth. And he wants to make sure that doesn't happen. He says, I don't want my sins to be reflected in the destruction of my descendants. But look at the last statement. That sounds kind of like a positive thing. But the last thing is, and that you will not destroy my name from my father's house. What's he concerned with?
His reputation.
I don't want my name to be destroyed from my father's house. Now that means certainly he wants heirs to go on. But I do think it also indicates that he wants his name to be well remembered. That's been important to him. All the way back to the sin in 1 Samuel chapter 15. He says, honor me. Make sure that I get honored. And he's still worried about that here. And so David agrees with that. Verse 22, David swore to Saul and Saul went home. And David went home with him, right? Saul has said, you're more righteous than I am. You're going to be king one day. Just when it happens, make sure you don't destroy my descendants. David does what? David and his men went up to the stronghold. He can go back to Jerusalem to Saul. He knows better. This is good. This has been a good thing that's happened here. But David doesn't trust Saul, does he? Is Saul trustworthy yet? Not at all. Not at all. In fact, we see something similar. Look in John chapter 2 for just a second. John chapter 2. This happened very early in Jesus' ministry. One of his first visit to Jerusalem after he began his public ministry. And John chapter 2, go down with me to verse 23. He says, when Jesus was in Jerusalem at Passover during the feast, it says, many believed in His name. Now, why? Well, it says, when they saw the signs or the miracles or the powers which He performed. They believed in His name when they saw what He was able to do, the signs. But look at verse 24. But Jesus did not commit Himself to them. Why? Because He knew all men. And He had no need that anyone should testify of man, for He knew not what was where? In man. Now, David's not God to know what's in man, but he's been around Saul long enough, and he's known Saul's, you know, heart and life, and he's, you know, knows enough about him, even from Jonathan and so forth, that he knows, I don't trust what he's just said to me. I mean, remember back when Jonathan talked David out of, you know, I talked to Saul out of killing David at one point in time, and then very quickly after that, Saul is throwing a spear at Jonathan. Not just David, but at Jonathan as well. So, he doesn't trust him because he knows what's in man. He knows that Saul's heart is not right. Because wickedness proceeds from the wicked. And he knows that's still what's going on. There hasn't been a real change in Saul's heart. And so David doesn't commit to him in the same way that Jesus didn't commit Himself to these because He knew what was in man. Next time we're going to continue with this study. We'll look at the next chapter. The next chapter to me is a very interesting chapter. We meet one of the worst men you could ever meet in your life. A man named Nabal. And you meet one of the best women you could ever meet in your life, and that's a woman named Abigail. And what's strange is that they're married. They're married. And we're going to look at a challenge that David goes through with meeting this couple. And we'll see how there's sort of a relapse on David's part. Going back to not trusting the Lord, but someone is sent to help him. So we'll look at that next time. So if you got a chance this week to read 1 Samuel chapter 25, an interesting story, and one that has an impact on David's life for many years to come.